coming to you surrounded by annoying announcements, crying babies, and surly travelers at the Chicago airport. Welcome to the latest episode of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. As always, I am your host, now president of SIMSEC, Matthew Hipple. I'm looking forward to taking the reins this year, seeking new opportunities to engage with you, our membership, and our listeners, reaching out to new organizations, and continuing the production of high-quality content that keeps you coming back. Should also congratulate the rest of your new SIMSEC leadership team, the winners of our 2015 to 2016 officer elections. We have our new vice president, our treasurer, Victor Allen, secretary, Josh Tallis, director of external relations, Catherine Dransfield, our director of membership, and former treasurer, Brett Perry, and replacing me as director of online content, engaging in the core of our business here at SIMSEC, Dmitry Filipov. We also have Emil Main continuing as director of operations, and Matt Mrigi, our former director of membership, will be coming on as our director of publications. And my congratulations also goes out to our new board, as well as my predecessor as president, Scott Cheney Peters, who will continue on as our board chairman. Now those pleasantries aside, today's topic. The third offset, Defense Undersecretary Robert Work's strategy that unabashedly embraces the U.S. technological advantage, pushing the throttle to the max. As a dronophile with a partiality for space, obviously I'm a huge fan, but others worry this technological emphasis will pull attention and resources away from other foundational areas that have a competitive advantage in the modern era. Admiral John Harvey, United States Navy retired, joins us to discuss what he has loosely called the human offset, the core importance of talent management and development, along with some of the flaws he sees with pushing technological advantage in the modern day particularly. It's always a pleasure to have Admiral Harvey on board the podcast, so we're happy to see him again for this topic. Now, sit back, relax, and we will return with Admiral Harvey after this short break.
Do you like the Sea Control Podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SIMSEC website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
And welcome back to another episode of the Sea Control Podcast. We have a particular treat for you here today. We are joined by friend of the podcast, so you have heard from him before. Secretary Admiral, I guess we can call it. Is that a title? We'll use that. Secretary Admiral John.
That sounds great.
Governor Militant, John Harvey, United States Navy, retired. Last time he was with us, he talked parts about his career and some of the things that he'd seen and leadership and exercises he'd been out on, and it was a really, really great discussion. And today we are going to talk about the third offset strategy. And before we do that, of course, as we do with every one of our guests, sir, I'd like to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself, where you're coming from, where you are in your life, and kind of the perspective that you're attacking this problem from.
Okay, Matt. Again, thanks for having me back. It's always a pleasure to re-engage with the home team where I spent so much time. Right now, I'm, as you alluded to, I work for the state of Virginia. I'm a member of Governor McAuliffe's cabinet as the Secretary for Veterans and Defense Affairs. I've been on that job for about 18 months. Getting there, how I got to that job is a very interesting story, but we probably don't have time for that today. But it's been a very, very rewarding 18 months, and I'm very glad that when the governor asked me to take on the position that I consulted with my boss, Mary Ellen, and we decided to give it a try. It's been fascinating after 39 and a half years in the Navy to be able to go into something completely different, state government, which I had very little real knowledge of, work in Richmond, work with the General Assembly, be part of an administration, and for a portfolio that is very rewarding in and of itself, but it also represents the common ground that on the political spectrum is a casual observer of Virginia politics. There's no lacking of contention there on a number of very gut level issues. But the veterans issues and defense issues represent this common ground where across the spectrum, people come together, find, we put forward what we think is a pretty viable program, things we can do and can get done, and people rally around that. And that's been very, very good to see. And I haven't had to get into the steel cage death match of politics. People respect my position, and you understand I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I don't do public politics. I'm here working for our veterans in Virginia and for the relationship with the military services and the people who serve in Virginia. So that's what I'm about now. And theoretically, this goes for another 2.5 years, and then we'll see what happens after that. But that's what's going on today.
We'll throw you into the ring for position as SimSec president. How does that suit you?
If nominated, I will not serve. If elected, I will not.
You're not giving me a warm fuzzy here about my new job. So you've given us an excellent segue. You're talking about the human factor, and today's podcast, of course, is talking about your ideas in regards to the third offset, and what you and I had sort of discussed in a side conversation is the human offset. But before we get into that, some folks may not fully understand or have not heard of the third offset. And to give a quick summary before I turn it over to you, it's essentially saying we look at our technologies and some people say that maybe it's a disadvantage. They look at sort of the asymmetric capabilities of our enemies. And some people say no, that technology is actually an asymmetric advantage and we should push those technological advantages to the very edge as far as we can to go sort of against that instinct to worry about their vulnerabilities and rather emphasize their strengths. And perhaps, and of course with your experience being the former Fleet Forces, having all this time and experience in the Navy to sort of see that technological sea change from the Cold War to today when you retired, what are your thoughts about the third offset itself?
Well, okay, good. My career spanned Cold War, then into the, which was actually the development of nuclear weapons was kind of the first offset strategy in dealing with the existential threat that the Soviet Union posed in Europe, around the world. How do we respond to that? How do we ensure the continued existence, and I use that word advisedly, the continued existence of the United States. And so nuclear weapons developed as an offset to what was perceived to be an overwhelming conventional advantage in Soviet forces, and you thus got into the deterrence and sort of the very stable situation in a sense that deterrence gave us, as unpleasant as it was and as mind-boggling as it was to think about it. It was a situation that brought strategic stability. And even though we were, in a conventional sense, much less in our forces structure than the Soviet Union. So that's when I started, 1973, coming out of Vietnam and Cold War still going strong. So we segue into the second offset strategy, which was in this resurgence of the Soviet Union in the 80s during the Reagan era and actually the Carter era, this global kind of push, the invasion of Afghanistan, new threats to Europe, and again, from a position of conventional inferiority, how does the United States respond? Well, that was the second offset, and we'll just call that the precision weapons and everything that supported the ability to precisely deliver, in command and control, GPS, the warhead technology, everything that goes into that network that enabled us to deliver precision weapons that constituted the second offset strategy. And the third offset strategy now is what Secretary Work was talking about. And yet I have some significant concerns for that. And I want to preface my remarks is that I'm not a Luddite. I don't believe in, okay, what we had 20 years ago was good enough. We don't need to change it. We just need to use it better or more effectively.
You are on Skype with me right now, so I don't think anybody has any confusion about that.
No, so I appreciate it. Things like, Navy integrated fire control, you know, the basis for CEC. When I was commanding Cape St. George, a very advanced developed baseline for the Aegis system with cooperative engagement capability, the latest standard missiles. You know, I'm into affordable, achievable, evolutionary technology that makes sense for us in a number of ways. But what I am not into is saying technology is the answer for us solely. We just need to be better at technology. DoD is no longer the driver of key technologies that, as opposed to the first two offset strategies, that was really only DoD who was interested in that. Well, it's global now. We have had the democratization of R&D, and the markets, the big markets, are not in DoD anymore. The big markets for advances of all kinds of technology, whether it's bio-related, nano-related, whatever kind of adjective you want to put in front of the word tech, in cyber, cybersecurity, the whole gamut of this stuff, communications, everything, the big markets are not DoD, which tells me that everybody's going to get to play in this. So to identify and define something that, you know, the United States claims, okay, this will be our advantage, and no one else is going to know about this, and no one else will understand what we understand and be able to do what we're going to do. I find that to be a very dangerous proposition to entertain, because we don't drive that market, we don't own that market, and a lot of people are going to see what we see when we see it. Now, I don't presume that Deputy Secretary Warwick and Secretary Carter are naive about this. But I think that the idea that the technology, that we can come up with something that we will be able to turn so extraordinary to our advantage, similarly to what we did in the past, I just don't see that in the future. Plus, plus the big issues we face are not necessarily amenable to a technological fix. Now, and again, I'm sure the leadership understands that, but what happens is you announce something like this, and okay, the third offset, as it goes down through the chain of command and reaches the strategic action group at ComNav SurfLamp, you know, as it works its way down, I think the force and the intent will sometimes be diluted and misdirected, and we'll be coming to this big tech chase when the issues in the South China Sea are just as much, non-technical in terms of what we're trying to do. The issues in the Middle East have very little to do other than with, the social media and the reach of ISIS globally in terms of bringing that ideology forward to young Muslims all around the world. In Europe, what Putin is doing, that's a pretty low-tech operation that he has disrupted everything on the continent now. So I don't see a technical fix, if you will, for any of those particular issues. Technology certainly has a role. What CNO has been pushing hard on the electromagnetic spectrum, getting the Navy back into that and lining up against potential threats in the Western Pacific, that makes a hell of a lot of sense. But I don't see that as an offset strategy. That's just good, sound operational practices and technology that supports them. So I worry a little bit about this chase for the magic bullet, the silver bullet that's going to solve our problem in a particular area. And I don't think that's where our principal focus should be.
I do think it's fair on the silver bullet point. And you and I are speaking in slightly more simplified terms because there is a lot going on in this concept. It is a suite. So when we say silver bullet, we're talking about technology, because no one's saying there's one particular technology that if we push it to the limit, that it'll solve our problems. They are talking about multiple ones. But when you talk about sort of the democratization of all these technologies, there was a great article just for our listeners. If you look at the Wall Street Journal, The Hyundaization of the Global Arms Industry by Joe Katzman, and that was back in the beginning of April. And it describes how, nobody's really going to beat the United States soon in technology, but they're going to come close, and there is a lot of it out there. And it, just as you said, there's other tech leaders, and as long as it's not happening within the walls of DARPA or within the walls of the Pentagon or wherever these things are happening, someone else is going to get their hands on it. And what you described in the email exchange that we had, and the reason that we're driving to this podcast today is that you think we should emphasize something that we were referring to as the human offset strategy. And rather than me give the sort of bluff summary, I'll just open the floor to you to describe your thoughts on how we should drive down that path towards military dominance.
Yeah, well, let me give whoever may be listening to us, give them two examples of what I'm talking about. And they're deep in history. The first is lots and lots of people love the Shakespeare play Henry V, the speech of St. Crispin's Day. That's the band of brothers. That's where those magic words came from, William Shakespeare. But they came about before the Battle of Agincourt, where a very small, outnumbered band of English yeoman soldiers with very few mounted knights, mostly carrying hand weapons, but something called the longbow. And they were not noblemen. These were just the guys from the farm, the guys from the woods who came out and constituted the British army. Vastly outnumbered by hordes of French knights, wonderful chargers, bred for this, the newest armor, the finest lances, swords, so there was the technology piece, the longbow versus a charging mass of knights. But there was also the fact that the British were able to bring in that period of time, the English were able to bring in those very lowly farmers, not worthy of even talking to a knight, who were able to come in and take advantage of very simple technology that didn't require a forge, didn't require metalworks, knowledge of metallurgy, all those tremendous technical advantages that the French were able to bring to bear were negated by a very straightforward weapon system, but that was used extraordinarily well. So that's Agincourt. And, of course, there was a great English victory there. And then let's fast forward to 1940 and the Germans coming across France. The French had far better tanks, far better equipment, far better communications equipment. They had better everything. But what the Germans did was took what they had and put it together in a better way. On the balance of technology, the French generally were superior to what the Germans had. But the Germans were able to operationalize this. And this is the Blitzkrieg. They test drove it in Poland, and then they perfected it in France in the race across France to the Channel and really put it all together in a way that the French were not prepared at all to respond. So, technology offers an awful lot, but it doesn't offer everything. What I think is really important today, particularly since technology is it's globalized, it's democratized, everybody's going to see it, and the markets are elsewhere. We got to have people who can reach out there and understand what's going on, I think. So we got to have people who are very, very adaptable, who can understand these big trends that are going on and can make use of what's out there perhaps faster and better and in a way that makes more sense for our operational challenges. I think that's where our advantage lies. The young lieutenant, the second-class petty officer, those are the people I think we need to really focus on, and that means the talent. Every time I hear people talk about technology, I say, okay, at the same breath, you ought to be talking about talent. Because how are we going to use that technology to help out in the challenges that we face? So I'm big on adaptability, understanding what happens in there and rapidly making sense of it, bringing it in on a very large level to focus on the significant operational challenges we face, those challenges that are not necessarily amenable to solely a technical advantage.
So how do we gain this advantage? Now, we do have this advantage now relative to our adversaries. We do have a very good training program, and for some of the damage that we did when we went towards that technological answer, went to computer-based training and what have you, kind of towards what you're talking, and we're bringing back in the in-person training. With your particular ideas, compared to what's going on now in the Navy, how do you see this being, and I hate using this buzzword, but it works, operationalizing this idea? How do you see it coming to fruition? What do we actually need to do to see that happen?
I'm very, very encouraged to see what Admiral Bill Moran is doing as CNP. You know, deep in the bowels of the Bureau, and I'm a Bureau guy, okay? And I understand the dark corners of those buildings in Wellington and D.C., and I know where the bodies are buried and who buried the bodies and where they're buried. So I understand there's been a lot, but there's been a lot going on in those buildings from a lot of very good people about how do we unlock our personnel systems. You know, the last in the public discourse recently, an awful lot about how the compensation is being revamped. You know, that's actually going to come out in this Congress in the authorization and the appropriation bills, changing the retirement system, changing some fundamentals about what it means to compensate the all-volunteer force. Well, the next step is, and it really should be in parallel, you can't talk about compensation without talking about, okay, what are your goals of this? You know, what do you want your personnel system to deliver for you? Where, what kind of talent, when do you want that talent? How do you develop that talent? How do you retain that talent? How do you deploy that talent? And that's your manpower and personnel system. And that's sort of the other side of the coin of your compensation, okay? So I'm very encouraged because I think Admiral Moran has understood that the issue is talent, that the issue, particularly with the millennials coming in great force throughout the Navy, a different way of looking at how they view what's a career, how they view their service, and how they view what they expect in parallel with the ability to serve in the Navy, what should come with that and what opportunities should be standard along with their, you know, what we do. You use the word training a lot, Matt, but I think training's at the end of the process. Training is where you prepare sailors for a known scenario. You train on a firefighting on board a ship. You train in strike group, strike ops or integrated air defense. That's training. This is what I'm talking about is before that. What do you need to be training on? What are you aware of in terms of what's out there? What are your potential opponents doing? What are they looking at? Where are we going to be doing this? What challenges do we face and what are the responses to those challenges? How do you put this together and then look? And then it's the Apollo 13 moment. I mean, you come in and dump this bag of stuff on the table and say, okay, here's what we've got to work with. And we got to figure out how to put this round filter into a square hole, okay? And then go on and succeed in the mission. So there's going to be the people, I think, at every level. And this is really important. This isn't owned by post command commanders. This is not owned by chief petty officers. I think we're going to have to understand what do we have to do after we get people started, whether they're in from OCS, ROTC, the academy. After we get them through boot camp and through that initial tour where they kind of get the big picture, here's what this Navy thing is all about, how do we challenge them to understand more about here's our mission, here's this world we're going to accomplish this mission in, and how do we understand what the big, big rhythms of that are going on out there, whether it's technical, whether it's cultural, you know, and how do we bring that together and say, okay, this is now how we got to accomplish this mission in a very, very different environment than what we've had in the past. No clear-cut enemy, no existential threat, lots of volatility, lots of violence, lots of big things going on, near-peer competitors. I mean, we got rebels in Yemen launching scuds into Saudi Arabia, okay? I mean, this is a brave new world that we're facing. And I want people to be able to recognize this different reality and then be able to understand what's happening out there, bring that back, and be technically literate to then say, okay, there's a technical component to this, there's a thinking component to this, there's an operational component to this, and here's the mission that we're supposed to do. How do we put this together and come up with our yeomen with longbows to beat those knights out there?
So you're almost talking about I'm trying to find the balance here between a word that could both throw training and education kind of into the same concept, but you're looking to push the idea almost from what it sounds of mission command further down the chain of command. So now it's not mission command to the CO, but it's the CO saying mission command, hey, this is our mission, this is what's going on, crew execute while I'm up here on the bridge, and sort of independent-minded folks that can fix the problems, that can make the things happen all by themselves with even less direction than ever before. Am I reading that correctly, or am I taking it too far?
I think I would value the education opportunities that we offer the force across the pay scale. And I think that's the most important thing we're going to do. How do we introduce this force to the world around them and enable them to go out and have these great learning opportunities that then we bring back and say, okay, now we've invested some time in you where you go out and do this. We've made it possible for you to step away from, you know, the engine room for a little bit and think bigger, understand more. Now let's get back and solve the problem we're facing. How do you turn that education, what you've gotten, understand, as you said, under mission command, here's our intent. Now, how do we turn this into training opportunities that get at the operational challenge? So it's investing more across the board in the force to enable them to educate them and enable them to educate themselves. I think professional education is not just a year doing the standard routine at a war college, okay? Professional education is, people got to internalize, it's a lifetime in the Navy. And it's something that it's your primary responsibility. It's not the Navy's responsibility to get you to the right course at the right time. It's your primary responsibility to as a professional, to see to your own education. And we ought to help you do that and give you opportunities with a very broad view of what that professional education is.
So there are some efforts ongoing right now that I'd like sort of your thoughts on. In particular, you have Rear Admiral Kilby is working on the program, the Warfare Tactics Instructors, and you've spoken about two kinds of training. You've talked about training on the back end where you're honing people's skills and they've already gotten this holistic training, and then you're talking about the holistic training itself. Now, this is post-division officer training, turning people into warfare experts in certain areas. Do you see that as part of what you're discussing now, or do you see it more as that finishing school, that training we were talking about?
Oh, I think it's part and parcel if we do it right. I mean, we've got these things. You got, the Aegis Training Center, okay, where you learn about whether you're a FC2, a lieutenant, or a going to your command, as I went there before I went to Cape St. George, you learn about a specific combat system and how that combat system functions, and from a very detailed level to a broader level. Then you got this thing called SWAS, again, which is a continuum of education and training, on the various aspects of the profession as regards to surface warfare. What does it mean to be a division officer? You know, what are the tools you have? What does it mean to be a department head? What are those tools, expectations? What do we think we can help you learn to go and succeed at that position? Well, you know, then we go to what Admiral Kilby, Admiral Roden, Admiral Kilby have developed out there in terms of what was kind of a missing link, I think, at least in surface warfare. You know, this idea of, okay, now we really want to put these things together and figure out the operational expertise. And you're going to bring people in who are successful at the technical steps, successful at the administrative steps, who have the professional desire, the ability to learn on their own, bring these high performers together and down in San Diego and develop these colonels who can go out and be planted everywhere else, you know, seeds that you can go out and plant around the forest, who will be the ability to look at and say, okay, what are the opportunities? I know the technical piece of this now. Here's the challenge. I'm the person who can go and put the challenge and the technical piece together and see the opportunities. What is the connective tissue that we need to worry about in order to accomplish the various missions we've been given?
Now, it sort of comes as second nature, I think, to officers in the Navy, or at least I would hope it comes as second nature, that we understand that people really are the core, because your ship doesn't operate without people, it doesn't get underway without people, nothing operates without effective professionals. At what point in time in your career would you say, it doesn't have to be the moment, it could be any moment of sort of particular, sort of this subtle subconscious knowledge we have of the importance of the people under our command, when did that really come to the fore where you stood back and said, wow, you know, despite all this technology, we would have been up shit creek if it wasn't for, you know, this sailor or this particular piece of training where what you're talking about now you saw in action in a very real way?
Well, there was one event that always has stuck in my mind when I talk about, when I think about the American sailor. And I was the CEO of David R. Ray. We were deployed. We were in the North Red Sea in 1992, in the summer of 92. We were enforcing at that time. Remember where we were? Operation Southern Watch had just been instituted. I was supposed to be in the Gulf with the group we deployed with, but one of the East Coast spruances had essentially got fired and got sent back to the Mediterranean. And so I got diverted and went around to take place. We were enforcing UN sanctions against Iraq up at the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba. So you had traffic coming through the Red Sea, traffic coming out the Gulf of Aqaba, and traffic coming up the Red Sea out of Bab el Mandeb. And so we were going alongside inspecting, containers, you know, stopping ships, looking at papers, blah, 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 blah. Well, so one night we were there doing this, and we got an emergency signal from one of these, I mean, it was right out of a Humphrey Bogart movie. You know, it was one of these tramp freighters that just looked like it'd been around the world for 5,000 times and hadn't ever gone in for an overhaul or a paint job. And a medical emergency, and they were there, and we were right here, and they just instinctively said, we need some help. It turns out the master's wife was pregnant. They thought they'd be in port by the time she started delivering the child, and you can appreciate this now, dad-to-be. And she's obviously going into labor, but also they could tell it's not going very well, and there's no medical people on this tramp freighter. Well, the added attraction is that this is the captain was Muslim. And so very concerned about, who comes over and helps his wife, and the tug between what our corpsman would need to do to at least understand what's going on. We didn't have a doctor in bar. We had an independent duty corpsman, HM1 Ray Dingulong, a Filipino-American, came in, and a wonderful, wonderful corpsman. Whole crew trusted him, classic independent duty corpsman, very talented guy. And I called him up. I said, okay, HM1, here we go. I'm going to send you over there and, do the best you can with what you got and let me know what we need to do here to support you. It was going to be very problematic to put her in a helicopter and fly her to where? Egypt? There was a lot of complications. There's no carrier around, that we could just, give them the problem and say, okay, solve this for us, okay? This was something that the crew of the David R. Ray was going to take care of. And so we sent HM1 over there with the command senior chief, simply because his command senior chief was, very mature, could handle a lot of things very well. One helper, and they went over there. And HM1 Dingulong, in this, you talk about the strategic corporal. Well, here's a guy who goes over there and delivers this baby prematurely. She's bleeding. He has to deal with that. It's very, very difficult, touch and go. But he stabilized her. And then we were able to work with the Egyptian Navy, who could have cared less about the whole thing, and at least then highlight it so we could get this into a port and expedite their arrival in port for further on care. And there was nothing you could prepare for. You would think this would happen. I just had to look HM1 in the face and say, go over there, do the right thing, do the best you can. And in an era when, like today, when people are looking for the relationship from from the West to Islam, to Muslim people, like our response to the tsunami, in Indonesia, the most heavily populated Muslim nation on the planet. And they're all getting, it's the Abraham Lincoln Strike Group, those sailors who are there making a difference for so many of them. And this is where we just dumped it on an HM1. Go do the right thing. Stakes were pretty high. And, you know, he really came through for a variety of reasons. That's always been very salient in my mind to explain what I'm talking about.
So to bring it back to that third offset part, and you mentioned before that, of course, you weren't a Luddite, and you were involved with projects like the Ponce, which went from a almost decommissioned amphib to a laser-toting psycho command center driving around Arabian Gulf.
I'll take credit for that, too. That was my idea.
So when you look around at what the Navy's developing now, in sort of a doff of the cap to the third offset, what technologies do you think are the most important? Which ones do you think that these new sailors, these empowered individuals that you're talking about with the right training, with the right background, what do you think is most important for us to put into their hands? What is it that we're developing now that you think will serve the Navy the best in the future technologically?
Autonomous vehicles of every kind. I think that's just incredibly important. And so if I had my last dollar to go to tech, I'd find that it's good. My first dollar is going to go there, and so is my last dollar. You know, whether it's undersea autonomous vehicles and a sensor net that can help communicate with those vehicles and help those vehicles respond as we need them to in very, very contentious, high threat, difficult areas. Autonomous vehicles in surface for surface vehicles, particularly for mine technology. I mean, this idea that we're still talking about, the mine countermeasure ship in the middle of the minefield, just mind-boggling, quite frankly. And we've got to get out of that. Smart mines are going to require, autonomous vehicles to really sweep them in an operationally viable time, if you will, given the challenges we face. And then in the air, I'm kind of with Secretary Mabus. I think the F-35 should be the last manned strike fighter that we build, and then becomes in. We got to, I think, the beginnings of that with UCLASS, the great debate going on. Is it a deep strike, stealthy, delivery vehicle that can penetrate anybody and go anywhere, or is this going to be, lesser in terms of stealth, strike, and carry and range capability? But it's autonomous vehicles, I think, are something that is worthy of an extraordinary amount of effort. And then you got to understand, Matt, the real key is not just the vehicle itself, but what I'll call the McCluskey moment of autonomy. Now, you know what I'm talking about here. So Wade McCluskey, he's the air group commander on board the Enterprise on June 4th, 1942. So he's gone, and he's taken his squadrons, all the dive bombers and the two squadrons of dive bombers off Big E. He's gone to where he was told that's where the Japanese carriers are. Well, here's a shocker. He gets there. No carriers. Okay. So fuel limited. He's got all the weapons. They know what's at stake. So Wade McCluskey, Lieutenant Commander Wade McCluskey, he's circling there thinking, okay, now what do I do? He looks down and he sees a Japanese destroyer doing about 33 knots right to the northeast. Well, Wade McCluskey is enough of a naval officer to know that the only thing that the destroyer is going that high a bell at on an absolutely straight course is because he's not where he's supposed to be, all right? He's late to station. Well, it turns out that the destroyer was engaged in about a three-hour duel with the USS Nautilus, a very old submarine. And so the destroyer stayed, now is trying to regain station with the Japanese strike group. So McCluskey correctly reasoned, that's where I'm going to go. And then he gets there and the rest is history. But that's the McCluskey moment. How do you build into your autonomous vehicle that kind of decision, that kind of artificial intelligence that you can get that kind of a decision when you need it and at the time, you need it and with the kind of data that you're going to need to make that decision. So autonomous, it sounds wonderful to say it. It's a great, like you said, a great buzzword. Everybody's yakking about it. But it's that McCluskey moment in autonomy that makes them worthwhile, that makes them valuable. And how do you get that artificial intelligence cooking? Because you probably won't have the communications. You're going to, you know, how much are we going to trust these vehicles in these situations that are truly, you know, desperate situations for us?
Real denied environments.
So the vehicle and what makes it truly autonomous and what makes that autonomy useful to me is where I spend my time.
So there you have it. Autonomous people and autonomous vehicles, all in the same bin, right?
You got it, man.
Sewed it all together.
Our view for the future.
Before we go, if you have any final thoughts, if you've been reading any books recently or working on anything in particular, just something that it can be on this topic, it can be on anything, really, kind of scratching on the back of your mind that you could give our listeners here as we approach our departure time.
Yeah, I have a book for everybody that I think you'd enjoy on so many different levels. The author is named Stephen Bungay, B-U-N-G-A-Y. And the book is called The Most Dangerous Enemy, A History of the Battle of Britain. And it's a treatment of the Battle of Britain, the likes of which I have never seen before. Now, I'm not the most widely read ex-naval officer on the face of the planet, but I read a lot and I enjoy it. It's always been my hobby. But this book I have found profound in his treatment of it, his writing ability. It's a joy to read, but how he approaches this as this organization of the Luftwaffe versus the Royal Air Force, the battle of the organizations, and then the people within those organizations dealing with the extraordinary tactical challenges when so much was at stake. And he tells the human story very well, the organizational story very well, and then what's incredible is, you know, the technical story. You talk about technology, you know, Spitfire versus, you know, Messerschmitt and the Hurricane, Spitfires, et cetera, versus the German bombers. So I think it's well worth, it's a great read, well worth people's time, and it's The Most Dangerous Enemy, A History of the Battle of Britain, and the author is Stephen Bungay. And I recommend that without reservation to all my friends and former friends and still on active duty.
And without reservation, sir, thank you so much. This has been a fantastic podcast.
It's always a pleasure, Matt, and good luck with the impending familyhood.
So hopefully I won't be getting a kid too much like myself. Like I said before the podcast, I think my mom would call that payback.
Well, good luck down there. Have fun.
Thank you, sir.